Hey everybody, and welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Mo Docchio, and today my guest is Britt Robson from The Athletic. He covers the Minnesota Timberwolves, so we're going to get into that saga. We're going to dive into Spitgate. We're going to talk Lakers, and we're just going to talk about what else is going on in the NBA. So, you ready to tip it off? Britt, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Awesome, man. You wrote a fantastic piece on The Athletic, and I'm just going to say it now. If you're listening to this and you're not a subscriber to The Athletic, you need to, after you finish listening to this, go subscribe, because it's great crop of writers. Really, it's the dream team of writers in every city, and Britt's one of them, and you got to go read his piece on the state of the Minnesota Timberwolves. Britt, what the hell's going on in Minnesota?
Well, I've been covering the team since 1990, and I think this is pretty close to peak dysfunction, which is really saying something. I mean, it has a lot to beat out. I think peak dysfunction before was Mark Madsen on the final day of the season when the Wolves needed to tank, basically chucking up three-pointers, this dorky, spastically moving big man who very rarely shot threes in his life, literally chucking up bricks willy-nilly in an attempt to blow the game. And that's right up there. You know, there's been some others, Latrell Sprewell turning down 3 years and $21 million because he needed to feed his family and then never getting another NBA offer. I mean, it's just, you could go on and on, but I think the idea of setting up a team that has three studs on it, two max guys at cornerstones, and then Jimmy Butler, and then having Butler, he says, he told Tom Thibodeau earlier in the summer that he wanted out. Tibbs denies this, but in any case, the rest of the world found out about it about 2 weeks before training camp, that the team's alpha player and core leader suddenly wanted out, and the Timberwolves team that had made the playoffs for the first time in 14 years the previous season suddenly was in disarray. Then you had the spectacle of Butler, after demanding to be traded, not being traded, Tibbs essentially refusing to trade him. Then you had Butler come in to a practice. The fact that he was even allowed to practice to begin with was kind of strange. But then he curses out everybody, says you can't win without him, arrives late, leaves early so he could do a prearranged interview with ESPN in which he gives his side of the story, and essentially tried to embarrass everybody connected to the Timberwolves enough that they would be able to trade him just to get rid of him. It turns out that probably lowered his value because people began to suspect whether or not Butler was just too loose of a cannon, so that backfired. Tibbs kept him on the team anyway. He comes the opening night on the home opener, gets booed. By the end of the night, he's leading the team to a victory, and people are, not many, but there you could hear them, who were yelling MVP. So you have a situation where Butler has made an agreement with the owner of the Timberwolves, Glenn Taylor, to play as hard as he can as long as Glenn Taylor is saying that he will do everything he can to trade him. So that's the situation we're in now. The Timberwolves won their second out of four games last night. Again, another home win, beating a very good Indiana Pacers team. And Butler, again, was in the middle of it. But as a Timberwolves fan, are you supposed to cheer or not? Is the guy who has pretty much been the key figure in your two wins, he's walking out the door at some point. That has never wavered in terms of his message to the team. So, meanwhile, you're kind of stalling and certainly relegating the development of the two guys you're paying $148 million and $190 million to over the next five or six seasons, Karl-Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins, to bit player status, certainly in terms of the pecking order and certainly in terms of the way you run your sets. So that's where we're at right now. The Timberwolves, after winning 47 games, are confronting a really, really rough Western Conference with their top three players totally in disarray, their coach totally on the side of the guy who wants out, and the owner basically letting it all happen just to see what happens next.
Yeah, let's kind of break it down a little bit. Let's start with Tibbs. Is Tibbs crazy enough to just not trade Butler and go through it all year? And listen, we all know he's leaving at the end of the season. If he doesn't get traded, he's still leaving as a free agent. I really can't imagine a scenario in which he stays unless they win a championship, and that still seems very unlikely. Is Tibbs crazy enough to just, hey, no, I'm keeping him, I don't care?
Well, I do think that Tibbs probably senses that his chances of filling his he currently just embarking on the third year of a 5-year, $40 million deal. I think if Butler leaves, he mortgaged, he's traded a draft pick that was not as good of a draft pick in return to Chicago, but got rid of Zach LaVine and Chris Dunn. Varying opinions on whether or not that was a good deal. I continue to maintain it was a good deal with Chicago, but the bottom line is if Butler walks and you don't get anything for him, that turns out to not be a good deal, and it certainly was a win-now strategy deal that if you're not going to win now, is not going to happen. So all I'm saying here is that Tibbs understands that as long as Butler's on the team contributing in a positive manner and the Timberwolves are competitive for a playoff berth, he still has a job. I think the second that the Timberwolves go on a huge losing streak or Butler leaves and the return for him is what most people expect, not worth what Butler is worth, that Tibbs' job security goes way down. I think Tibbs is smart enough to realize that. So there's that practical strategic angle. Then there's the stubbornness of Tibbs. Tibbs believes in doing things his way. Butler is his guy. What's crazy is Butler has always maintained that Tibbs is his guy, even as he's basically made a rash decision that really puts Tibbs' career in jeopardy. These two guys are joined at the hip except when they're not. And so you've got a situation where, yeah, I think Tibbs is really trying to extend this out as long as possible because this is, in Tibbs' view, what his blueprint was. He is not going to punt his blueprint on his own come hell or high water. Both Butler and Taylor have made an agreement, but I still think that Tibbs and general manager Scott Layden, who pretty much does whatever Tibbs wants at the end of the day, they're going to hold out and continue to maintain that there is not a deal that fulfills their criteria. As long as the Timberwolves are competitive, they may be able to string that out at least until the February trading deadline. But again, you know, the Timberwolves are about to embark on a really, really rough stretch of schedule. They're in Toronto on Wednesday. They've got Golden State, Utah on the schedule in the next five games. They are probably not going to be able to maintain this 500 pace. They played four teams that are relatively not great teams. So you got a situation where it's a wait-and-see situation. Everybody's expecting Butler to be moved. Whether it is sooner or later, the question becomes now, is it going to be sooner or is it going to be later? And what happens to the Timberwolves in the meantime? It remains a pretty absurd situation, and everybody here in Minnesota, I mean, the fan base in the home opener, a lot of people came to boo him. Then Butler played very well, and a lot of people stuck around to cheer him. The second game, the place was half full. It was a 10,000 in a 19,000 capacity building. That was probably the announced crowd. It was probably more like 7 or 8 in the building. And this is the second team's second home game coming off their first playoff appearance in 14 years. So the fans are voting with their feet. And it doesn't look good for the blueprint of Tibbs right now.
Yeah, I that's the thing with the initial trade to me was always kind of a, hey, we need to jump forward right away, and you know it's bringing in a guy like Butler is, like you said, a win now move, but you had two young guys that didn't appear to be ready to win now, and you know the hope, I guess, from Tibbs was that Butler's going to bring these guys along. Well, clearly personalities didn't work out. I mean, I heard his you know, midway through last season was already hearing a little bit of rumblings of, you know, the there being a bit of a rift. So it's kind of shocking. I Tibbs is in a tough spot. I also wonder a bit about, you know, Karl-Anthony Towns. You know, he wanted to see how the situation was going to play out before he signed that extension. Butler announces a trade demand, and then he immediately signs that extension and things like that. So, from his expectation, he's probably hoping, right, Butler is going to get traded, right?
You would certainly think so. I mean, when we heard about Towns delaying the signing of his contract, everybody assumed, and it was even reported on some sourcing, that Towns was waiting for Butler's situation to be resolved before he signed the deal. Now, Towns, of course, at Media Day, the day before training camp, said that, no, it had nothing to do with Butler. Nobody believed him when he said it. It is a situation where, until last night, when they had a really interesting lineup on the floor that included a really dogged defensive player, Josh Okogie, a rookie, and Tyus Jones, who always plays well with both Towns and Butler, perhaps the guy in the team who plays best with those two together. But until they had that lineup out on the floor, Towns and Butler were not playing well together at all. And that starting unit was really not functioning well. And last season, that starting unit was the best thing about the Timberwolves. They had no bench. They finished 30th in the NBA in bench minutes. But this season, when Butler has been playing with the bench has been very strong. Now, they've improved the bench, but I also think the idea of Butler not being on the court with Towns and Wiggins was a net positive for the Timberwolves thus far this season. As I say, last night, they did have a period of time in the second half where they kind of found that magic again, and some of it had to do with the fact that you had Okogie and Tyus Jones out there, and also another acquisition, Anthony Tolliver, spacing the floor. So the short story on this is that no one expects Towns and Butler to be best friends. There's too much that has happened here, and Butler has always maintained, even when he's gone off for 33 points in 36 minutes against Cleveland in the home opener, no one has ever said that this is a sign of a turnaround, that this is a situation where Butler's going to change his mind. Butler says he wants out. Butler is the kind of person that isn't going to back down from what he originally said. And at this point, he'd be crazy to back down. He's already done so much to corrode the team that it's best for him to leave at this point.
Right. And can you just kind of envision a scenario where I almost feel like we're going to get another crazy practice or locker room story or even something in game with Butler if this kind of drags on longer than you know he's hoping or I mean he wishes this thing was done already. I think there's already like an artificial deadline that he had said like trade me by Friday or something. This was a while ago, and stuff. But I can kind of see something coming where at some point he's just gonna have we're gonna have another one. We're gonna have the sequel to this practice, and hopefully it'll be on a TV game that I'm watching.
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly a possibility. What is crazy is that Towns and Wiggins, who are the offended parties, you would assume. I mean, the narrative throughout the offseason was that Butler was disparaging Wiggins and Towns throughout the second half of last season for poor defensive recognition and overall lack of effort. And everybody will recall on social media that when news of Butler's trade request was reported in various places, Andrew Wiggins' brother came out and said, hallelujah.
Right.
Butler responded. Steven Jackson came in. That was probably one of the few times where Wiggins and Towns engaged in some kind of public pushback. Behind the scenes, as I mentioned, Towns used his contract as leverage. But what's crazy is you do have a situation where both Wiggins and Towns have gone out of their way not to confront Butler over this. Now, you would assume these guys are two max guys. They are the future cornerstones of the team. They could take control. In fact, there is a part of me that is kind of disappointed that they haven't seized the power that is granted to them, given their contracts and their status on the team, and basically said, look, you know, we need to get this thing resolved so we can move forward with our careers and our season. This middle ground is a bunch of bull. You know, it's not real. We're not operating in on firm footing here. I think the fact that neither one of them have done that, and that Butler continues to clearly be the alpha in the locker room and on the court, is not a good look for either Towns or Wiggins. But maybe it has to do with the fact that, as you mentioned, neither one of those two guys are really ready to be team leaders, even though Wiggins is in his fifth season now and Towns is in his fourth.
Right. And I think what's going to kind of carry over a bit is, I mean, listen, it was hard enough to get players to come to Minnesota already. We saw it during the KG era. We saw it with the Kevin Love era. And I think guys who are ready to win might shy away from trying to join Cat and Wiggins just based on what this whole drama and hearing from Butler about, you know, their mentality. And I mean, we saw it in the Rachel Nichols interview about, like, he made it just really seem like they're not about winning. And I think that might hurt him come, you know, down the line for years with free agents.
Well, and not only that, I do think that they have some, both Wiggins and Towns have some rehabilitation to do. Yes, they're getting paid. You know, the bottom line is that Wiggins and Towns both got the max they can get. Towns got more because he made an all-star team last year. And we'll be able to make even more if he makes an all-star team this year. But if you look at the GM surveys, for 2 years running, entering his second and third seasons, Karl Anthony Towns was named by NBA general managers in their survey as the player they would most like to start a franchise with. Beginning his third year, the percentage of that was down compared to the year before. But beginning his fourth year, this year, he was not even in the top six. Wiggins was regarded as somebody who was capable of a breakout season on a couple of votes in the NBA general managers. That he no longer appears on any surveys. And indeed, the consensus around Andrew Wiggins right now is that his ability to even become an above average NBA player who is a dynamic third wheel on the team, or at best a second scorer and decent defender, which is not max money production, that may be, I think at this point in time, most Timberwolves fans would take that from Andrew Wiggins rather than the desultory play and the inconsistency we've seen and the lack of subsidiary stats, rebounds, assists, steals, blocks, defense. Andrew Wiggins has proven he can be a scorer, but in the NBA today, that is not a max money skill. You need to be able to be a multiple skilled player, and you also need to be able to be an inspirational presence with your energy and your leadership. And those are things that Andrew Wiggins has not even come close to demonstrating that he has. Indeed, it's been things that have been whispered about him and that have dogged him since he came out of college. Cat, on the other hand, is somebody whose defensive inconsistency and just inability to step up in that way, whether it's recognition, effort, the fact that there's still a great debate whether or not he should be a five or a four, whether it be a power forward or a center, those are things that are dogging him. His shooting is off the charts. He remains one of the most promising sweet shooting big men perhaps in NBA history. He was probably about three dozen free throws made away from being a 50-40-90 guy last year. Imagine a big man being setting those parameters. So offensively, it's not a problem with Towns. again, part of it is, the locker room. He has a tendency toward trying to please everybody and trying to say the right thing. And his defense, again, is not up to caliber. And Wiggins has also underachieved. I think those things are going to hurt this team moving forward unless, they turn it around. And let's face it, your investments kind of dictate your strategy. And the fact that the Wolves have invested so much in these two guys, at this point in time, that's sunken cost. Unless you really want to bite hard, swallow hard, and lose Andrew Wiggins for quarters on the dollar, even though he's only 23 years old, you really have a situation where you are riding the production of Towns and Wiggins into the future. And unless they really step up, yes, this team is stuck in, at worst, the purgatory where you can't get big picks, but you're first round fodder in the playoffs if you make the playoffs at all.
Yeah, that's going to be the tough spot for them going forward. So I want to kind of veer a little bit away. I mean, listen, normally this would be the headline for a few weeks, but the NBA season has kicked off with quite a bang. And just this past Saturday, we had a legitimate NBA fight, which is, we hadn't had one since, I guess James Johnson and Serge Ibaka threw some punches last year, but we hadn't really had a real fight for a while. And
right,
it led to Spitgate. Twitter kind of spending all Saturday night trying to figure out who actually spit on Chris Paul. Then the Zapruder film came out, and it turned out that Rondo did actually spit on Paul, and we had that whole drama. And punches thrown. The NBA suspended Ingram for 4 games, Rondo for 3, Paul for 2. And my question to really kind of start out is, were all of those a bit lenient to you?
Yes. I would have been happier probably doubling everybody. I mean, Brandon Ingram came in, he cold cocked somebody from the side.
Right.
I mean, I just think you can, if that's 4 games, imagine the precedent there.
I mean, he was surprised. Did you see the clip of him with the reporters yesterday? They're asking him about it, and he's like, "Hey, I'm really happy it was just 4 games. I thought it was going to be more." Even he was shocked.
Right. Now, Adam Silver has traditionally been more lenient than David Stern was, his predecessor. And under normal circumstances, like you mentioned the James Johnson altercation, that type of situation, you can understand how, you might have just a smattering of games there. But I think when you have a situation where somebody's coming in, you're not squared up with somebody. And if NBA players, let's face it, they're the I think they're the finest athletes in the world. They're also huge and powerful. And if somebody wants to throw a punch that somebody else doesn't see, you really need to make sure that when that happens, that the message gets sent. And I don't believe the message was sent. In fact, if anything, I think the message was sent that, if it's even worse than that, if the guy goes down and you really hit him with something where he's hurt or something, maybe you'll get 10 games or 15 games. Maybe that's worth it, in the cold calculus of NBA hoops, I think that you really have to send a sterner message than that. So, yeah, I think that was a mistake. But as to the original incident, I think the circumstances kind of made it ripe. Rondo and Paul have dislike for each other that's gone back a decade. Both L.A. and Houston started slowly with disappointing results early in the season. Rondo and Paul are both guys who are really being called upon to be the rocks for their respective franchises. I mean, I know LeBron as well, but Rondo's supposed to be that beta guy to LeBron's alpha and be the bridge between the rest of the team and LeBron. So I do think you had a situation that was fraught to begin with, And then, you know, we don't know whether or not Rajon Rondo had his mouthpiece in and the spit was accidental. Knowing Rondo's history, I doubt it. But, you can't discount the possibility. But we also know that Chris Paul is not adverse to mixing it up as well. He's got always has had a loud mouth, always has been a provocateur. And so you have that situation. None of it is really surprising given the circumstances. What is surprising, as you mentioned, is the leniency, especially on Ingram.
Yeah, and the thing about Ingram, it really looked like a kid who's been bullied who just snapped. You know, and anybody can get it. I mean, he went from pushing James Harden to confronting an official when he got a technical. Like, it looked like he was going at the official for a moment. I forget his name. And then, you know, he gets pulled away, and then the melee breaks out, and then he comes charging in and throws that punch. And the other thing for Ingram is he's incredibly lucky he didn't hit P.J. Tucker. Because that would have been suspension would have been the least of his worries. I'm just saying.
I think PJ Tucker probably would have been headed to prison rather than suspended if that had happened.
I mean, it would have been a whole different. The whole melee would have been completely different had he landed a punch on Tucker, and you know, and to Rondo kind of spitting on Paul. I mean, I don't blame Paul for reacting. I'm with you. Paul's kind of a. You know, I know CP, like he is a loud mouth. He is a guy that kind of stirs up stuff and things like that. But Chris isn't going to react unless he gets, unless he has a reason to. And I mean, I'm not a tough guy by any stretch of the imagination, but if somebody spits on me, I'm going to throw, I'm going to get in a fight. I'll probably get beat up, but I'm going to get involved. But I'm with you too. I just think really, I was just shocked at the length of it. I thought, like you said, I think everybody should have kind of gotten doubled, especially early to start the season. You kind of want to set that tone if you're Silver of like, this will not be tolerated. And I really think he's nailed a lot of things. I think he missed the mark on this one.
Yep. Yeah.
I'll tell you what, though. Between, I know three guys that will never be in a photo booth together, no matter how hard we try. We will never get Chris Paul, Rajon Rondo, and Brandon Ingram in a photo booth. You know, and I don't care how hard my friends at Brand Active Media would try to get this done. I don't think it's ever going to happen. But I got to tell you about my friends at Brand Active Media because they're awesome. They do the photo booths at weddings. They do it at private events. But they've also done very big events. They've done the NFL draft. They were at the Pro Bowl. They were at the NBA All-Star game last year. They have big events. So whether you're looking to book for just, you know, having picture day and having fun on, you know, with your AYSO soccer team or a fun corporate event, or you have a huge event, I highly recommend you reach out to my friends at brandactivemedia.com. Tell them Mo from the Jump Ball sent you. They'll give you a great deal. And that's all I got, man. Check them out. I can guarantee, though, they will never get Rondo, Paul, and Ingram in a photo together, the three of them. Maybe one each individually and Photoshop it, but it ain't going to happen any other way.
And don't forget James Harden. I mean, he had a little bit of a role in this too, which is not surprising. I think there was a point where Harden was kind of goading Ingram a little bit. And so you have that situation too. It just turned out to be one of those situations where, given the personalities involved, it wasn't like you went, oh, you know, I can't believe that guy was in the middle of
right.
this, you know?
The other thing is, can Chris Paul come to Staples Center and not cause problems? Last year we had the tunnel incident. This year we have this.
Right.
Like, I'm just very curious what's going to happen his next Staples Center visit. You know, and I'm going to be it's going to be primetime viewing the next time the Rockets and Lakers play. But I'm going to warn everybody right now, the refs are probably going to have a directive to control that game, and there will be a lot more whistles than normal in that game.
And what is kind of, I know he took some crap for it as somebody who did not appear to be backing his teammates, but I thought LeBron did a heck of a job there calming Paul down.
Yeah.
You know, there was a circumstance, you know, where Paul was able to vent his frustration verbally to LeBron while they were, wound up together. And, you know, I think it's well known by everybody that those two are very close and have played together a lot, gone through a lot of contractual stuff together. And I do think that Paul cooled in the time that LeBron had him in an embrace. And I think that given the fact that, as you mentioned, he was spat on by a guy who he doesn't like to begin with, that really helped things. I thought, once again, you know, LeBron has been the adult in the NBA room countless times in the last 5 years, and I think he showed up in that way again the other night.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think the people that have been coming back at it, you know, like LeBron not backing his teammates, I think that's just silly. One, the guy he was closest to at the moment physically was Paul, you know.
Right.
And so that's the first guy you go in to pull out. They don't talk about Melo really kind of trying to calm Ingram down. you know, like everybody just kind of wants to point out LeBron not being a good teammate and making a bigger deal out of it. The other thing that I really thought was more surprised, well, I have two things. One, Lance Stephenson was a peacemaker, which was good for Lance, but was was surprising. The other thing was, you know, Lonzo at first did pull Ingram away. And then, you know, when Ingram goes charging in, he runs right by Lonzo, and Lonzo doesn't even bother doing anything. And Lonzo kind of just trails off to the side. And this is the second incident. Last year we had that stuff. I think it was against Phoenix where he kind of walked away from a little kerfuffle. And, you know, when you look at it this way of like, yo, you got to have your teammates' backs and things like that. Like, that's just not, again, that's just not a good look for Lonzo. And he doesn't have to get in there and throw punches, but you got to kind of hope he does a better job sort of kind of trying to corral his teammates a bit.
Yeah, I think, again, you know, he's young, and the idea, his default position may be that he just puts his head down when there's controversy, given all the stuff with his dad and everything in his family. He began to learn that, you know, a default position may be low profile. And he was able to weather a lot of crap that was going on last year before he was injured. And so I can understand him, you know, pretty much saying, look, you know, I shouldn't be in the middle of this. But you're right. At the end of the day, you know, you've got to – you're on the court. Things are happening, you know. Unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with, you know – you're not thinking clearly because what's happening is happening, and it's interesting to see, you know, what people's natures are really like. As you mentioned, the one guy whose nature seemed to be totally at odds with his past behavior and reputation was Lance, and you mentioned P.J. Tucker before. If Rondo had spit on Lance Stephenson, there would have been ambulances outside the arena for that, too, as well.
Yeah. teammate on teammate crime.
There you go.
Since we're on the topic of the Lakers, we got to dive into their 0-3 start. You know, they lost an incredibly tough one to the Spurs last night, which was a highly entertaining game. They lost that Houston game. They lost to Portland. You know, they play Phoenix tomorrow. And then the schedule continues to get tough after that. I know they have San Antonio. I think you're going to see them pretty soon in Minnesota. It doesn't get easier. And, you know, the expectations vary. Some people were like they're going to hit the ground running. I think that was fairly unrealistic, especially if you look at LeBron's history with new teams. It takes a while to gel. But the problem is, in the West, with it being as stacked, you may not have that much time to kind of you can't go through a real bad run. You can't start 1-6, you know, or 2-5 and you know, be way behind in this potential playoff race. You know, what are you making? What are your thoughts on the Lakers' struggles to begin with?
Well, I was one of the few people, and I freely admit that I could still be one of the few people that is very wrong about this, but I did not pick them for the playoffs this year. I really did think that there's just a lot of moving parts here. You've got LeBron going to the West, and the West is a situation where you know, your quotient of quality opponents goes up considerably. Then you also have the fact that he's coming into an organization that is a storied organization. He came into it for basketball reasons, but he also came into it for non-basketball reasons. And so you have that whole organic dynamic that is going on. He did not come to a very good team. The second best player on the Lakers is who? It's probably Rajon Rondo, who has a checkered history. You know, when he tangled with Rick Carlisle and essentially got dumped out of the playoffs 3 years ago, 2 years ago, it was the question of whether or not he'd ever be playing in the NBA again. And then he had that situation where he got tangled up with Bill Kennedy with anti-gay slurs. I mean, you have a situation where Rondo is not exactly your rock-solid number two guy. So who is your number two guy? You know, it certainly isn't, you know, Lonzo Ball or Kyle Kuzma or Josh Hart or, you know, JaVale McGee. I mean, you can go just down the list. You know, Lance Stephenson.
I think
LeBron.
I think their hope was Ingram was going to be the number two guy next to LeBron.
And, you know, that's a lot to put on a kid who, you know, is, let's face it, if Brandon Ingram gives you 20-9 this year, which is good but not exceptional NBA play, his season is going to be regarded as somewhat of a success. You know, that's not a great number two guy in the Western Conference when you're trying to be a playoff team. I think people just assumed I had both San Antonio and the Lakers out of the playoffs, and I had the gall part on both. If you look at the history. You know, LeBron James has been in the NBA Finals, what is it, 6 years, 7 years in a row? I've lost count. And San Antonio, 22 years in a row in the playoffs. But you do have a very dynamic NBA right now, and I do think, as we're talking about the Lakers here, you also have LeBron slowly but surely throughout his career, especially as he gets older, beginning to take more control over not only what happens on the court, but what happens on the sidelines, game planning and substitutions and trying to figure out personnel and everything. And, you know, David Blatt got ceremoniously shown the door. And Ty Lue went through all kinds of mental health issues last year, trying to cope with the scrutiny that comes with coaching a LeBron James team. Luke Walton is has been around successful franchises, but this is a new cauldron for him. And so you've got a situation in L.A., obviously big market, a lot of expectations. I think the overwhelming consensus is that the Lakers are a playoff team this year. And so that's a lot of pressure in a lot of different ways. And so it will be interesting to see whether or not you know, I have faith in LeBron James in terms of being able to figure things out. I think he's one of the most intelligent people that has ever graced this game, and as well as being one of the best ever to play it. So I do think he'll figure it out, but I also think in terms of just the resources and the timing and the opposition, that is a really steep hill to climb.
Yeah, that's it's going to be really hard. I had them in the playoffs. I didn't have them in the top four like some people thought or anything like that. I think it's more likely they miss the playoffs than finish in the top four. I think it's a poorly constructed team around LeBron. Just not enough shooting. There's just and we're seeing it now. They're already 28th in the NBA in shooting below 30%, even though Lonzo kind of has looked good these past two games shooting the ball. I think it's really going to be a struggle. And if they don't find a way, you know, after 10 games, after 20 games, to be close to 500, I think the reality of them missing the playoffs is going to be a lot higher than people will want to admit. You know, I was with you with the Spurs once they got the injuries, but now after seeing them last night, I kind of think, you know, they might find a way to just sort of squeeze into the playoffs. I don't think they'll do much more than being a first round and out team, but They look a little bit more together. I mean, obviously Pop is who he is, and you know, they're incorporating DeMar DeRozan, but in general they just look a lot better in that regard. But one thing that Laker fans can use to help soothe the pain of starting 0-3 and their dreams not being realized is gelato. I don't know if anybody really knows this, but I think gelato is kind of a fix-all. It cures everything. You know, when you're down, you can never be unhappy when you have a good cup of gelato in your hands, whether it's in a cone or in a cup. I prefer a cup, but I know the best place in all of Los Angeles is Uli's Gelateria. There are two locations, one in downtown LA, one in 3rd Street by the Beverly Grove. You can't go wrong. Amazing flavors. They have passion fruit flavors. It's seasonal. So whatever's in season, whatever they can find at the farmer's market, they're going to make a fantastic gelato. And I'm telling you, if you go there, check out the Speculoos cookies. It is my personal favorite. It's one I get every time I go. So check out Uli's Gelateria. It's on Spring Street in the Spring Arcade in between 5th and 6th Street and by the Beverly Grove on 3rd Street. So I kind of wanted to dive into with the season, you know, what else has surprised you so far? Like what, you know, we're still early into it. We're really kind of, you know, 6-7 days into it. We've already had a crazy trade demand in a practice. We've already had a fight, you know, but what else has surprised you? What team has shocked you? What has surprised you so far this season?
Well, I'm one of the few, I think, that was surprised by exactly how dynamic the Raptors look. I had the Raptors as the fourth best team in the East, and it wasn't because they were bad. I just think that Boston, Philly, and Milwaukee all took really big steps forward. I thought it would take a while for the Raptors to be what they are. And you know what I forgot about? I forgot about Danny Green. I forgot that, you know, they got two Spurs in that deal. And Danny Green kind of had a really low profile, wasn't really firing on all cylinders, it seemed, his last couple of years in San Antonio. But, man, he works well in that offense, and he works well with Kyle Lowry and Kawhi. Those threesome with Ibaka down low, they really look good. And they're a formidable team going forward. I also think New Orleans has really pivoted on the momentum they got from that Portland sweep and their successful postseason last year. I really think that their team, you know, that offense and incorporating Mirotić the way they have, I thought that Randall would be a good pickup, and he has been. I think both of those teams have really shown themselves to be I think New Orleans is going to hang around, and they have a really good shot at getting home court in the playoffs. Oklahoma City, you know, bad record, but you have to understand, I do think injuries, you know, obviously Russ really hurts, and Andre Roberson being out, it killed them last year on defense. I think yet again, you know, you're losing your alpha offensive guy and your sneaky key defensive guy. I think that's really been not a surprise, but the fact that Oklahoma City is struggling is a little bit of a surprise given what everybody thought they would be. So I think those things, I do think that I've been impressed with the depth of the West. Everybody said it was going to happen, but man, you know, I mean, Phoenix does not look that terrible. Sacramento won the other night. You know, you just have Sacramento isn't going to be in any playoff conversations, and probably Phoenix not either. But you've got 10 or 12 teams. You know, Dallas, you know, you can always count on Carlisle. Now he's got Doncic. You know, that's a good upgrade. It's going to be a really fun NBA season. And then Houston, as a guy who really focuses on defense first, I think, you know, losing Mabute, losing Trevor Ariza, and losing their defensive coach, Bajalik, that's a triple punch there. And it's going to be interesting to see whether or not Houston can figure out how to be able to operate the way they do on offense and still have the kind of defense that they had last year. PJ Tucker is still a rock there, but you know, Gerald Green gets more burn in this rotation, and that's not a good thing for defense.
No, that is a scary thing. I think the Rockets defense has been something that I've been banging the drum on. You know, as soon as they lost Ariza, I was like, oh, that's all bad news for them.
Right. And Mabute, also, I mean, the thing about both those guys is that you could play them together if opponents had really good dual wings, and yet you could keep one good wing stopper on the floor if, you know, there was only one guy that you really had to worry about on the wing. But you always had somebody who could check a really good wing. And I'm not sure that you know, is as viable a presence now.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, the talk we kept hearing was James Ennis was going to be the guy that can give you most of that. And, you know, I never believed it. I didn't buy into it. I've watched them the first couple of games, and I haven't been. I mean, they've looked very disheveled. I did a really long thread on Twitter of a bunch of defensive breakdowns that were just communications and not really kind of being on the same page, whereas last year right away they were clicking. So there's a lot of concerns for me on Houston's defense. And you touched on it too, Blizdelic leaving, you know, literally almost a week before training camp, you know, is a big blow for them. That's your defensive coach there, and that's the guy that helps kind of, you know, it's like a defensive coordinator. That's your guy. That's a huge blow for them, because D'Antoni is not known for his defensive coaching abilities. I did want to touch on, you mentioned Danny Green, and I think that's something that people don't talk about a lot in that Kawhi trade, is he was more than a filler. I know, he, like you said, he had struggled a bit in San Antonio. I think sometimes some guys have a hard time playing under Coach Pop, and I think he, you know, at a certain point, I think there's a little bit of a liberation for Danny Green. So I won't be surprised to see him. I know it's just a few games now, but I won't be surprised to see him kind of have a really solid year for himself. You know, just kind of feeling a little more liberated, a little more comfortable within Toronto. And man, keep your eye on the Raptors. I think they're really going to be a problem and a thorn to the Boston Celtics, who are struggling a little bit right now.
I agree, and I also think one of the reasons, another reason I had kind of downgraded the Raptors was not really knowing much about Nurse as a coach. And, you know, you got a situation there where I have a lot of respect for Blair Brown, respect for or Brett Brown, I think, whoever the coach of the Sixers is, and Brad Stevens, and you know, and I think Budenholzer is somebody who is really a good fit for Milwaukee. So I didn't know whether or not coaching-wise they would be behind the curve there. But I've been impressed with his rotations and what he's done. I think they came out of training camp ready to roll almost right away. Obviously, Kawhi makes you a lot smarter coach if he's healthy and ready to go.
Right.
But I have been impressed with the fact that a rookie coach who had a relatively low profile has his team so ready to play.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, you weren't alone in that. I had the same concerns if I was just like, again, a rookie coach. You know, he might be a great coach, but, you know, it's different when you go from being a head coach or being an assistant coach or a head coach in the G League to eventually an NBA head coach. It's a little bit, you know, it's always tougher. So I had the same concerns you did. Do you have any concerns, real quick, before I let you go, about Boston? I mean, they're struggling a bit. You know, Kyrie has had two games where he hasn't shot the ball well. They lost to Orlando last night. They barely beat the Knicks. You know, are there any concerns on your end, or do you think it's just a matter of time and they'll figure it out?
I think they'll figure it out just because they're so deep. But I do think, as a lot of other commentators have mentioned this before, their depth is almost a problem. You know, I mean, Rozier and Smart really played well in the playoffs last year. Now, you know, you got to really figure out how to get minutes for those guys. Both of those guys have, you know, they're team guys, but they also have a lot of pride in themselves and big egos within themselves. And so I think keeping them happy is important. I think Hayward and Kyrie both have to figure out a way to accept perhaps lesser roles than I think Boston at its best is not a star generated lineup roster. I think guys like Jaylen Brown and Tatum really are as important to that franchise as Kyrie and Hayward are. And I think that I have faith that Brad Stevens will figure it out. And I have faith that, you know, they'll be able to move forward and win the East, or at the very least be right in it with Toronto at the end of the day. I also think that there is always inevitably a hangover. You know, teams that play into late May, while everybody else who didn't make the playoffs is done in early April, even if you, you know, lose a first round series or something, those games, I think, hurt you in October and November, because you're really not, you know, the games you're suddenly playing, even though they're regular season games, are just not as intense as the games you last got through playing the previous spring. And so it's hard to get that mindset back.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I'm one of the few that thought, you know, was really concerned that the depth would actually be a problem, just because it's hard. Listen, Jason Tatum made the leap, you know, we saw in the playoffs, and he's looked great, except last night he was terrible. You know, we've seen, you know, Jaylen Brown continue to progress, and all that, and I just kind of, you know, Terry Rozier and everything, and like, it was really interesting in that game against the Raptors, down the stretch in a close game, you had Marcus Smart and Jaylen Brown both sitting on the bench, you know, towards the end of that game, and I'll be honest, they both didn't look happy, you know, and I understand it, they're competitors and they want to be out there, so I think there's a little bit of, there's a potential for some tough waters kind of coming ahead in terms of how to figure out, you know, roles and guys accepting their roles, because all these guys are young. They all want to be the guy or at least really have a big role with the team. So it's going to be a very interesting season to see how that shakes up. You know, Brad Stevens has been great as a coach, but this is probably going to be his biggest challenge, is how does he get everybody to buy in now into these roles?
Right. And then under the headings of great problems to have, can't you imagine Danny Ainge basically pruning the roster and throwing in a number one pick to get a superstar, you know, maybe taking a hard run at, you know, Anthony Davis or somebody, if, you know, I don't know who, but I do think that you have so many great wing players and you have so many draft picks that if you just do a mix and match of some high picks and some really quality wing players, you might be able to get an alpha guy, you know, one of the top 10 players in the NBA. And if it's the right guy, you know, you really could set yourself as a legitimate counter to Golden State if they're not already.
Yeah, I mean, the fortunate situation for Boston, and let me be honest too, their depth is a good problem to have, like you said. And their depth in assets, you know, that cupboard is brimming full with assets, you know, from anywhere from draft picks to players that they could include in deals, that they're going to be players whenever there's a disgruntled NBA player. You know, anytime somebody's looking to get traded or there's a trade demand, Boston can top any potential deal out there if they want to. It's just a question of if they think this is the right guy, this is a good fit. So they're in great position in that sense to tweak and do whatever they need to on around the edges. Britt, I've taken way too much of your time. Please plug, you know, what you got coming up. Like I said, The Athletic is definitely worth a subscription, reading Britt and everybody else and that all-star lineup. But please, Britt, plug what you got coming up next, or, you know, and where people can find you.
Well, I'm in The Athletic, writing about the Wolves once or twice a week. Usually we try to estimate it to be about 6 or 7 columns a month. So I'll be doing that. I'll be continuing to cover the Wolves. I also write about music for a variety of publications, mostly jazz, but other things for both the Jazz Times and the Daily Papers and some other folks here in Minneapolis. But in terms of hoops, you know, I'm on Twitter at Britt Robson. I usually live tweet the Wolves games. So if your team is playing the Wolves and you want to check it out, You know, I used to have a notebook that I, you know, would write by longhand everything that I was thinking about, so I could go back and write my columns. And I use my Twitter feed as my notebook during games, so that I can go back and get impressions. I'll be contradicting myself in the middle of games because all my observations are on the fly when it happens. But if people want to check that out, that you'll get my thought process on how I watch a basketball game. And in the meantime, you know, I've been pleased with The Athletic. I've been gratified by, I signed on with them about a year ago, and you know, the fact that they're getting guys like David Aldridge and, you know, these just some real bedrock guys, you know, Ethan Strauss out in Golden State, just some people I really admire. And so it's been gratifying to me to see what they've done. So, yeah, I'm happy where I am, and I appreciate you having me on. And I always enjoy your Twitter feed and your film studies, and so I'm glad you invited me on.
Oh no, thank you. I'm happy to have you on, and I'm sure at some point when the trade goes down, we'll have another conversation.
Sounds good.
All right, Britt. Thank you again. That's it for our show. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever else you go to listen to your podcast.